TUC Radio San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness.
Alexander Coburn on the CIA. In August of 1996, the San Jose Mercury News published an extraordinary piece of investigative reporting. Dark Alliance, written by Gary Webb, revisited the involvement of the CIA in the smuggling of drugs into the United States in order to raise funds for the Contras. That drugs were brought here had already been established during the Iran-Contra hearings, but nobody had yet been able to pinpoint where some of these drugs were sold and to whom. In Dark Alliance, Gary Webb reported that for almost 10 years, Nicaraguan exiles with ties to the CIA sold tons of cocaine to the street gangs of Los Angeles. They were sold as crack cocaine, predominantly to African Americans, and much of the millions of dollars raised was funneled to the Contras. The story became a huge issue in black communities across the country and even prompted an unheard-of appearance by CIA Director John Deutsch at a town meeting in south-central Los Angeles. John Deutsch promised an investigation by the CIA's Inspector General. However, only 4 weeks after the publication of Dark Alliance, a national media campaign denounced Gary Webb, and eventually that campaign forced his resignation from the San Jose Mercury News. The story of Dark Alliance and vindication of Gary Webb is the lead story in a new book on drugs and the CIA, co-authored by the noted Nation columnist Alexander Coburn and In These Times editor Jeffrey St. Clair. The title of the book is Whiteout, and Coburn came to San Francisco in October of 1998 to introduce the detective story that is at the heart of the book. He spoke at the independent bookstore Modern Times. Alexander Coburn.
Hi there, good evening. When Jeffrey and I embarked on the book, mostly in our minds was what happened to Webb in 96, when he, in the San Jose Mercury News, had told the story of Contra drug trafficking into the United States and the CIA's complicity with this. The series was well received initially. It was published in August of 96, and it was picked up pretty quickly, particularly by black radio. It became a big issue in South Central LA pretty quickly. And just when the story was, so to speak, going critical and really taking off, the established papers opened up on him. And within about 3 or 4 months, his own editor was apologizing. His colleagues at the San Jose Mercury News were attacking him. And within 9 months, he'd pretty much been forced out of the business. He now works for the state of California. The question with Webb was, initially we were asking, why was Webb Savage so? And we concluded a number of things. One, I think they were very worried by the fact that it was a very, very big issue in black communities. And really, it challenged the credentials of the state in a pretty fundamental way. If the state declares it is fighting a war on drugs and you find a leading agency of the state trafficking in drugs, this strikes at the basis of the state's credentials, opens major questions about what a war on drugs actually is. And no state, no powerful, sophisticated state, is inclined to let that go unchallenged. There was a feeling among the elites that this story had kind of got out of control. They really had to try and recapture the agenda on this story, and this meant a savage attack on Webb. You can see it happening. We tell the story in the first bit of the book, how quickly it happened, and how all the blackbirds hopped on the telephone wire right away. It was, so to speak, a signal shot from Howard Kurtz in the Washington Post. It's also interesting to see how similar all the attacks were. They were all cretinous attacks. They would say things like, he didn't get a statement from the CIA. This was regarded as a savage indictment of Gary Webb, that he did not ring up the CIA, hello, did you smuggle drugs or not? In fact, we were attacked in the New York Times for not doing that, not obeying the courtesies of a preposterous formality. There was nothing new in the CIA's involvement and complicity in trafficking in drugs in the Middle 80s in connection with the war on revolution in Central America. It happened in every decade. So you had to ask basic questions. How did this come about? Why is it seemed to be part and parcel of the operations of a secret spy agency in the United States that it should be intimately and always involved with drug traffickers? We start the story where it started in the Second World War. And the CIA itself was founded in 47 with the OSS and the Office of Naval Intelligence, which in the midst of the war found themselves with three immediate tasks. One, they were preparing for invasion of Sicily and they wanted intelligence about Sicily. Two, they were worried about Nazi sabotage on the New York docks by sympathizers of the Nazis. And three, and I think very important, they were extremely worried about labor organizing on the docks by Harry Bridges, attacking the corrupt longshore unions in New York and bringing radical longshore organizing. They did not like that one little bit. They conceived of and put into effect an alliance with the mob. They went to see Lansky, who was the number two to Luciano, Lucky Luciano, who was the head of the mob, the organized mob, and at that time was serving a 40-year jail sentence in Dannemora prison in upstate New York. In fairly short order, Luciano was moved to more comfortable, still in prison, but a much more comfortable prison, more comfortable circumstances, and cooperation began. This was the founding moment. And you can see in germination then what happened after the war. The CIA, as a major soldier in the Cold War, they looked for their allies. And where did they look for their allies? Since they were doing war on the Soviet Union, on communism, and on the left worldwide, obviously their allies are on the right. Since a lot of dirty work had to be done, they needed thugs beyond and above the full-time thugs they had on the payroll. They needed money to pay their various assets, which needs money that can't be accounted for. Drug money is the obvious candidate. And so it was in France. They made common cause with the Corsican mafia in Marseilles. Same thing happened in Italy. And in China, you had the CIA. Its major client, of course, was Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang Kai-shek and his army, the Kuomintang, had already in the 30s been essentially living off management of the opium trade in China. When the Chinese communists pushed out Chiang Kai-shek, threw him out, where did they go? They went into the Shan states in northern Burma and took over control of the opium trade there. The CIA was quite happy to see this army paid for by drug revenues, and it was greatly in their interest to make sure this went on, that a standing army remained, which meant, of course, in the end, that they would help with the transportation of the opium to its refineries, refined into heroin and morphine, and from there it was distributed to Europe and the US. When the Vietnam War was being fought, the CIA naturally sought client groups such as the Hill tribesmen, and naturally was now trying to sustain them and preserve them as an asset against the National Liberation Front. So they would fly out the opium crop. The opium crop would be refined in Laos or Thailand and then sold on into Vietnam, where a lot of it went into the arms of American service people. And the rest was shipped back to Europe. This was the role integral to the CIA presence there. We follow the story through to Afghanistan, where in the late 70s, a fairly moderate reformer, Taraki, launched an effort to overthrow the feudal lords in Afghanistan. Among other things, he dispossessed the feudal nobles of their opium fields. in an effort to redistribute land. He naturally was seen by the US and consequently by the CIA as a major threat. And what became the largest operation in the history of the CIA, cost about $3.5 billion in the end, was set underway. This was in the era of Jimmy Carter. Carter was warned by his own, some of his own staff, notably David Musto, who worked on the drug policy side. He said, "You're about to do exactly what happened in Burma, exactly. You are in essentially going to fight a covert war that's going to end up in vastly increasing the presence of, in the world, on the world drug market, of Afghan opium." Very clear warning. He said it both privately in the White House and then publicly in articles in the New York Times. His warnings were, of course, utterly disregarded. And a lot of what then happened, of course, the Russians invaded, the Mujahideen were cemented together by Pakistani intelligence and by the CIA. And a lot of what happened in that war was actually not so much freedom fighting, so to speak, as maneuvers in who was going to get what slice of the opium trade. About 3 weeks ago, the New York Times ran a very matter-of-fact article talking about the opium trade out of Afghanistan, a bit as if they were talking about pork belly futures. They said, you know, the weather's been a little inclement this year, the crop's a little bit down, therefore the prices will firm up a little bit. Quoted a UN guy who was in charge of World Review of the Drug Trade as saying, yes, indeed, now Afghanistan had overtaken Burma as the leading exporter of opium and hence of the ultimately of heroin and morphine into the United States and to Europe. We also describe the activities of a strange airport in Arkansas, MENA, where a lot of the drugs were shipped into this country in the era of good governor Bill down in Arkansas. The third thread is really intertwined with this, the question of what exactly is a drug war? I mean, I guess in a civics class, they teach you that a drug war is when you combat drugs, a position that's completely refuted by history and merely looking around you. By and large, a drug war is a war either fought to make people take drugs. That's the first simple definition of a drug war. You fight a war, you point a gun, you say, take these drugs. That's what happened with the British when they fought two opium wars against China in the 19th century. They were trying to export opium from India. The Chinese Empire said, no, we don't want this opium in China. Things are bad enough as it is. The British said, we want the right to sell it. Kind of an early version of NAFTA, really. They, at gunpoint, in two very bloody wars, they forced the Chinese to accept opium. They only actually withdrew from that position in 1920. That's the first purpose of a drug war. Freedom to sell the drugs. The second purpose is the suppression of the left abroad and control of what the state would regard as dangerous classes at home. Two basic functions. Abroad, drug wars are wars fought against the left under the rationale of trying to suppress the drug traffic. You can see it again and again, particularly in the Andean countries. Practically every 2 weeks you'll see a picture of Barry McCaffrey or someone from the Pentagon conferring with the Latin American military saying X amount of war materiel is being sent down by the US as part of the drug war. Of course, those weapons then immediately used against left guerrillas and left insurgencies, used to arm death squads which attack labor organizers in the city and the countryside. This is a prime function of the drug war abroad, if not the prime function. Particularly good illustration in Mexico. After the Zapatista uprising in Chiapas, the U.S. supplies and training for, quote, the drug war went up sharply and led to fairly rapidly to a rise in death squad activity all over Mexico, actually, from people trained under these so-called drug programs. Domestically, it's always been, in essence, an attack on the poor and what the state regards as dangerous classes. It was a class-selected war. we follow that story through, particularly to Harry Anslinger, who should be as demonized a figure as J. Edgar Hoover. Anslinger was head of the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, a federal agency, and he was a very important figure in the demonization of drugs and his association with black people and with Hispanic people. He was the person who, with Hale Boggs in the 50s, father of Cokie Roberts, I'd like to follow these bloodlines down the decades, the first mandatory sentences for drugs, including a death penalty, was put in by Anslinger and Boggs in the Congress. And of course, you come to the drug war of Nixon, where the best analysis, really, of a drug war was given by Nixon, who, when he didn't think he was going to be recorded for posterity, could have a certain helpful frankness about him. Let's see. He was having a meeting in 1969 with Haldeman, discussing the drug war that was about to be unleashed. And Haldeman noted in his diary, quote, "Nixon emphasized that you have to face the fact that the whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to." You could not have a more pithy expression of what a drug war is about than that. And how did they do it? The blacks. And what he said, well, of course, you now have the present sentencing structures, where you have the sentencing imbalances which are put through in a race to the right between the Congress in 1985 and 6, and the government headed by Reagan. Congress, of course, the father of the House was Tip O'Neill. And that produced the 100-to-1 disproportion in sentencing for crack and powder cocaine. A more clear administration of law to single out the poor could not be imagined. And of course, the fruits of that sentencing structure are around us today. The record prison population, staggering imbalance of black people in prison, Hispanic people, compared to their percentages in the population. Huge prison construction. This is the drug war. People keep saying the drug war isn't working. It's not working only if you don't really understand what the drug war is. The drug war is a war against the poor, a selective war. And if you have a situation where in major American cities, like we quote the example of Baltimore, where at any given time of black males between the ages of 18 and 44, well over 50% are at some point of transit through the justice system, that is a war that's a very, very effective, doing exactly what was dreamt of it by people like Anslinger and Nixon. That's a drug war. And the final real theme of our book is really is to look at the agenda of the state. And the CIA, its role and performance down the decades. Some people not old enough to have lived through all that history might have a tendency to forget just what a truly horrible organization the CIA is, and the absolute ruthlessness and cynicism of the state when it's carrying out its agendas. People occasionally talk about a rogue agency or rogue agents. That's a pack of nonsense, 99.9% of the time. The CIA is a bureaucracy, an organization which does the purposes, carries out the purposes of government. It's a cop-out to talk about the rogue agency. It is part and parcel of the agenda of the state. That caused us to circle back on one theme that interests us a lot. In all the attacks on Webb in 96, there was one phrase that kept coming up, which was black paranoia. And one of the charges leveled against Webb was that he had catered to black paranoia, which was depicted as kind of this rough beast waiting to be unleashed, this very alarming paranoia. And usually these articles, there were hundreds of them, the article would say, well, there's some reasons for paranoia. You know, the slave trade, for example, might have excited a little bit of paranoia. Then there usually was a mention of the Tuskegee experiments. not usually saying exactly, reminding people what happened, which was that the federal doctors pretended to black men suffering from syphilis that they were curing them, whereas in fact they were doing nothing of the sort. They were very carefully noting the progress of the disease, monitoring its progress to just see exactly what happened. But we go through the various usual citations of black paranoia and actually outline why exactly this paranoia is eminently well justified. It's often said blacks have a fear that, you know, the feds are conducting vast medical experiments on them. Absolutely true. Absolutely true. And we've cited considerable history, whether it's, it's the CIA and the US Army, actually bombarding secretly communities in Savannah, Georgia, Sebring, Florida, with epidemic diseases in the 50s to see how they took. Actually, they admitted this in the late 70s after some very good investigative work under freedom of information. We look at the long experiments in the 50s and 60s on mind control when the agency would have its subcontractors, in one case in Lexington, Kentucky, administer LSD in enormously powerful doses for 77 straight days to black heroin addicts to see how that went. The drug association of the CIA was always part and parcel of a larger project as conceived at the executive level of government of the protection of the power structure, of property arrangements, of corporate arrangements. The final thread really is a detective story. We end with a chapter called The Uncover-Up. When Webb's story broke in 1996, one thing that happened amid the commotion in Los Angeles was that then CIA Director John Deutsch went to South Central to a town meeting, which was very obstreperous, and finally he said, "We promise an absolutely fearless investigation. We will unleash the Inspector General of the CIA. He will go through every document. He will review the entire relationship, if any, of the CIA with drug smugglers from Central America throughout the relevant period. And we will deliver the results speedily to the American people." 16 months later, in December of last year, if you've been paying attention, and you would have to be careful which paper you're reading, most newspapers didn't carry it, there was some stories began to appear, CIA clears self. Now, that was based, those triumphant headlines were based on the first volume, censored, the first volume of the CIA Inspector General, which they had not seen. It had not been released. They gave out the press release. And the journalists on the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the LA Times, which were the main antagonists against Webb, just printed the press release. In January, the CIA released the report, you know, 146 pages, fairly thick reading. At that time, then, there were no stories. Actually, if you read the report, this is what we mean by calling the chapter The Uncover-Up, there were major admissions. For example, Volume 1, the report described a cable from the CIA's Directorate of Operations dated October 22, 1982, describing a prospective meeting between Contra leaders in Costa Rica for, quote, "an exchange in the U.S. of narcotics for arms," unquote. But the CIA's Director of Operations instructed the agency's field office not to look into this imminent arms for drugs transaction, quote, "in light of the apparent involvement of U.S. persons throughout." In other words, they knew that an arms for drugs transaction can take place in the U.S. and did nothing about it. In 1984, the Meneses gang here in the Bay Area had been caught in what was the largest capture of cocaine in the history of the United States at that time. Among things seized in that raid by the cops was $36,800 in cash from the bedside table of one of the lieutenants in this gang of Nicaraguan drug smugglers and fundraisers. The CIA intervened and actually had the money given to the Contras. The CIA's Inspector General said the agency took action to have the money returned, quote, to protect an operational equity, i.e. a Contra support group in which it, the CIA, had an operational interest. Now, you would think that that would be a smoking gun. Here you have the CIA taking drug money and giving it back to the Contra drug smuggling gang, saying, this is our operation, it has to go to Nicaragua. What would you think you would need? It's a smoking gun. Of course, it wasn't written up in the press. Then came the second volume of the Inspector General's report. This time, there was almost no coverage at all. There was a story in the New York Times, and he actually did get the crucial thing right. The report states that in 1981, when the CIA was putting the Contra force together, they knew that the leaders of the Contras were planning to raise money by the shipment of drugs to the United States. This is said flatly in the report. The same report says that throughout the CIA knew at least 12 of the major Contra leaders were involved in drug trafficking. You can add to that the fact that when drug traffickers were arrested, the CIA intervened to have them released. Their planes, when the U.S. Customs Service and DEA wanted to intercept them, the CIA stopped the interceptions. So actually, here we are, just about 2 years from the Webb disclosures. And 2 years later, if you take the trouble to read the reports, the Inspector General's reports, you find the CIA Inspector General saying it's true. They actually, we've reached the extraordinary situation where the CIA, if you bother to read the fine print, has been more forthright about its role than the journalist trying to defend it. The Inspector General was Fred Hitz, who's now teaching at Princeton. I was actually just reading from a column of my own, which appears in today's LA Times, which gave me satisfaction because the LA Times was one of the papers that most relentlessly went after Webb, and it's nice to be able to write in the LA Times as I did. So, was the agency complicit in drug trafficking into Los Angeles and other cities? It is impossible to read Hitz's report and not conclude that this was the case. Which is the end of our detective story. Thank you.
That was Nation columnist and author Alexander Coburn. The book he referred to in this talk is entitled Whiteout and was co-authored by Coburn and In These Times editor Jeffrey Sinclair. Gary Webb also wrote a book entitled Dark Alliance. TUC Radio is supported by listeners like you. We do not accept funding for our programs. For the full 50-minute tape, Alexander Coburn on the CIA, send $10 to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. For a credit card order, call 877-TUC-TAPE. That's 877-TUC-TAPE. The music is by G.S. Sarshdev. My name is Mariah Gilardin. Thank you for listening.